when it comes to the movie The Passion of the Christ, and also to the story that's behind that movie. You know, we've been looking over these 4 weeks at the new thing here at Crossroads, and it makes you wonder, where does this fit into this? Is this just kind of maybe one more piece of the new thing? One more kind of spin on spirituality? I can take what I like from it, kind of leave the rest, and mix it into my nice new thing cocktail to help me kind of maximize my life. I know I have spent a significant amount of my life searching through these new things. As a matter of fact, it's probably defined most of the journey of my 39 years has been trying to sort through, trying to come to some understanding of all these different bits and sound bites we hear out there that people feed us or that we discover about what life is all about. How does truth fit into this, and where is the actual plan for my life in all of this? I've talked a little bit before, a little bit about how I grew up. You know, the early years of my life in Nigeria, my parents were missionaries. I haven't really talked much, though, about kind of my whole reaction during that time. And my brother and I actually becoming very disconnected from the things that my parents were involved in. Whether it was because of the sacrifices we saw needing to be made in our family's life, all in the name of, I guess, you know, kind of God. Whatever that it was, just becoming very disconnected from the journey that they were on. And finding for me, then when I became an adult, I needed to find something that worked for myself. And seeing a lot of these different sound bites that are out there, one of the things that was a bit confusing for me was there was a lot of sincere people. My parents, very sincere in their beliefs. My friends at college, very sincere, all over the board. And when we look at this new things we've been looking at over these 4 weeks, there are people who sincerely believe in a lot of very different things. And so I figured what it was all about was sincerity. I needed to sincerely find something that worked for me. You know, something interesting happened in my journey as an adult was I found my sincerity starting to bump into some very raw questions that I wasn't ready to deal with. And a lot of it had to do with some of the questions and issues that would come up around this man Jesus and how that fit into the other things that I was studying. And whether that be things in the Quran or things in other religions, the question kept coming back to the differentiator was, what about this guy Jesus? And so what I want to share with you a little bit this morning is kind of my journey in that. And I kind of have distilled my journey down to, I think there's been kind of three defining questions on my journey I've had to wrestle through. And not that I've definitively figured out every one of these and I'm the expert to talk about it, but I thought it just might kind of be helpful because from what I heard, it reflects a lot of the places that people are in here on. And I kind of symbolize these three questions this morning by these three chairs up here. I've spent a significant amount of my life sitting in these different chairs asking some of these hard questions that my sincerity was bumping up against. First one, this is a question I really kind of started coming to grips with just probably about a year or so out of college. I hadn't, you know, attended church in a long, long time. And I started hearing people, I think it was around Easter, I started hearing people talking about this Jesus story again. And one of the things that kept coming to me as I thought about this and I looked at what all the various, very different things people believed about Jesus is, you know, what's true? My defining question became, is it true? I mean, the story of Easter, kind of the typical soundbite you get, is that there was sin in the world. Jesus came, as was God, came to take care of sin, and he died for our sins and then rose again. And so my very basic question was, is it true? You know, I'm not really a big fan of just going and be a part of things because of tradition or because everybody else is, but I need to know, is there some kind of truth in all of this? Is it true? And I've spent a lot of time in this chair asking that question. See, because for me, one of the things that bothered me about a vast majority of my friends, whatever their faith was that when I would talk to them about it or challenge them on it, it always seemed to be so much more built on feelings and raw emotion than anything else. And I really longed for being able to add fact to this mix. Maybe it's because I'm naturally, you know, not a really strong feeler, you know, on those kind of scales. Now, I can certainly appreciate emotions. I mean, if they're, you know, if they come in a very predetermined, efficient, and productive way, you know, I can be as emotional as the next guy, okay? You know, litmus test, okay? I cried when Michael Jordan retired, okay? I did. All three times, all right? Seriously, I did. People appeal, you know, they seem to be so much more emotion-based, and I can appreciate that feelings are part of our life, but I said, you know what? What about fact? There's got to be some fact in this, because people are out there honestly feeling truths that are diametrically opposed to each other. There's got to be some fact and some false in all of this. And so I longed for some way to kind of be able to lay these claims from these world religions and these claims about Jesus against some kind of objective kind of yardstick. All of you got this when you came in, right? Everybody get this? They're doing their jobs out there? Yeah. You know, I really think about this from terms of what I was longing for when it came to faith. I know there's feelings, I know there's faith involved in this, but there are some claims I should be able to find some sort of objective measure to lay things against and say, you know, is it true? Does it measure up or not? And so the ruler kind of came, my defining kind of image of, hey, I want to lay these claims about what life is all about the future of my life. I want to be able to lay them against some sort of measure and see how do they stack up. And you know what, as I looked in life, I realized that we use measurements for a lot of things. You know what I've also found is that the more important the decision, the more crucial that we have the proper measurement is. Nancy and I are building a house right now. And I have always been proud of my kind of old 16-foot tape measure that I have. You know, I'm not much of a handyman, but I got the tape measure. I think I got it in high school or something. You know, I got it. So in the building of our house, I will go over there and kind of mix it up with the workers a little bit, you know. I kind of clip the... I'll somehow indicate the points of humor for you, okay? That is not one of them. I clip the tape measure on my belt, and I'll go over there, you know, and some, I'll see something. Oh, you need me to help you measure? You know, and they'll be like, we need a tape measure. I'm standing there, I got mine. You know, there's no respect for my tape measure over there. I guess it's just too small, you know, or just not precise enough. But, you know, and I thought about that. You know, actually, that's a good thing. You know, I use my tape measure to help my kids, you know, with projects around home, with the homework, things like that. But you know what? When it comes to my house, the stakes are raised. I want to make sure these guys are getting these measurements exactly right. Because the higher the stakes, the more important the decision, the more crucial the measure that we're using to tell whether it's how it stacks up or not. Well, we're getting pretty close, probably within a couple months of being in our new house. Actually, my builder may be here this morning. We're closer than that, I believe. You know, I just revealed my safety pad there. You know, kind of, we're going to be in the house in 4 weeks. Yeah, we're getting close to being in the house. And one of the things that I'm bummed out about getting in the house is new house hanging all these pictures. I mean, all the pictures that are going to be hung, and I just know in our old house, hanging pictures and hanging mirrors, getting them straight, you know, and are they leveled, and all this kind of stuff takes a long time, and it is a real pain. So I'm not looking forward to that. And then about 4 weeks ago, watching late night television, the answer came to me. You know, people say there's no miracles today. This was a miracle because right there on my TV coming right at me was the laser straight. Anybody seen this thing? It's like, it's got a built-in level and it's a laser and you put it on the wall and it shoots this red beam along the wall and it'll turn corners and go, you know, so that you can level things and make sure the line is all the way across. Incredible thing. So I was watching this pitch about the laser straight on this infomercial, and then they said that if I acted right now, I'm serious, they said, if I acted right now, I'd get absolutely free the Stud Finder 2. It's like, wow. Yeah, and you know what? Okay. I worked in marketing at Procter for 9.5 years. I'm not, you know, I don't consider myself a sucker, okay? You know, I'm not, I started thinking about this, I'm like, you know what? These infomercials, I mean, what? I don't think I'm going to order this, you know, send even $15.99 to someplace in Jersey, you know, to kind of send me this thing. I mean, I know what infomercials are all about. You know, the word sucker come to mind, you know, so I got mine in the mail about 2 weeks ago. And it's Stud Finder 2 and the laser, and it's pretty cool. Okay, watch your eyes, because apparently this will kill you or something. I'm not sure. But see that? I mean, look on that wall there. I mean, this baby will fly, and it'll put me a level line. Anywhere around the house. It's important. The more important your decision, the more crucial what measure we're using. So when it came to faith, I said, my goodness, this is supposed to be the meaning of life. I better make sure there's some kind of yardstick, some kind of measure I can lay these things up against. And you know what kind of bothered me? So I would sit in this chair. One of the things that kind of bothered me was there's a lot of people that went to church and people who said that they were followers of Christ. They were Christians. A lot of them seem to have this wonderfully circular logic to what they believed. You know, it'd come down to something like this, you know, around Easter time. Well, you know, why do you believe that Jesus was raised from the dead? Well, because the Bible says it's true. Oh, okay. Well, why do you believe the Bible? Oh, because Jesus says it's true. You know, it just seemed like a very circular kind of logic. I was like, you know, I can't go there. I've got to be able to somehow be able to measure this in a little bit more definite terms than this. Especially when I start to hear, you know, a lot of the sound bites that are out there, like, you know, that the Bible is not really what was originally written by Jesus' followers, that it's been changed over time. I mean, we looked at the Da Vinci Code a couple weeks ago. That's one of the claims in there, that the Bible has received all this political spin in the translations over time. Different kings, different rulers, people to keep other people down or to keep control in their hands have politically changed the Bible over the years. And you know what I thought about it? I said, well, how do you know? How do you know that it hasn't been? I mean, the copies that we have, how do we know even the handwritten copies haven't been changed over time? And so I longed for, I said, you know what, there's got to be some way to lay this claim about the Bible. Is the Bible even what was written by Jesus' followers or not? Are they really Jesus' words or not? And the big question seemed to be, well, is what we really have, is that what was written in the first place? And that was a big part of my journey. Probably about 2 years of my journey, when I could, was digging into this question. And I don't have time this morning to go through that entire journey, but if that's somewhere you're at and you're asking those kind of questions, I took my best shot at summing up my journey on that a couple of years ago here in a tape that's called The Bible Fact or Fiction, and it's available out at the Info Center. I'd encourage you to grab it. Some incredible stuff I found about the established academic protocol for how you decide if manuscripts from antiquity are true or not, are the real thing or not. And how the Bible comes out against those very objective academic measures is an incredible thing. And there's a lot more packed in there as well. But I think the best way I could sum up kind of where I came out on that question would be in a quote from one of the leading authorities on manuscript authenticity and antiquities, Sir Frederick Kinran, who used to be the director and principal librarian at the British Museum. Here's what he said at the end of the day of the research been done on that. The last foundation for any doubt that the scriptures have come down to us substantially as they were written has now been removed. Both the authenticity and the general integrity of the books of the New Testament may be regarded as finally established. That, for me, did a pretty good job of summing up all the research that I'd seen in this area. But, you know, that wasn't quite enough for me, though. Because then I started also thinking, you know, all these claims about this guy Jesus, if he was what he said he was, wouldn't there be other things that were written about him? Wouldn't there be other references to him outside of the Bible of his existence and who he was? But yet the only thing you ever hear about him is, you know, things that were written in the Bible. And then I get back to this circular kind of thing. Now, I know at the time that literacy rates were not incredibly high, that the historical records that were primarily written for kings and rulers, you know, to describe military conquests and cities they'd built and things like that. But I thought surely somebody outside of the Bible would have referred to this guy, if nothing else, as, you know, that he was a bad seed or something. Somebody would have referred to him. And then I remember being in a bookstore and looking at the history books and discovering this guy by the name of Josephus, who was not a follower of Christ. He was a Jewish historian. He wrote the history of the Jewish war. And in about 80 AD, he wrote this account of this guy by the name of Jesus and described him as a wonder worker and described the fact that he was crucified. Is this guy not a follower of Christ? One of the most authenticated historians of his day. From 80 AD, he's writing about this guy who was a wonder worker, did things people couldn't understand, and that he was crucified. And then I discovered this historian by the name of Thallus. Again, not a follower of Christ, but a Roman historian. And at about 50 AD, he wrote an account of this strange thing that happened. The strange thing that happened, that when they killed this guy Jesus, this daytime darkness fell over the earth like they'd never seen before. This guy, not a follower of Christ, this Roman historian, is describing in detail the exact same thing that the Bible says happened in the middle of the day when Jesus was crucified, that darkness fell over the earth. And I just discovered the Babylonian Talmud. Again, not followers of Christ. But here in the Babylonian Talmud, they describe this guy by the name of Jesus of Nazareth. And they say he practiced magic that people couldn't understand. And that he was executed on Passover's Eve and listed 5 of his disciples by name and said that they actually healed sick people using the name of Jesus. And so I saw things that I'd never seen out there before. They were out there. That there were references to this guy, even ones that just called him a troublemaker, but that he did things that people couldn't understand. But then I remember also thinking about how I would hear people talk about these predictions, these prophecies that are in the Bible, in the Old Testament of the Bible, that part that was written before Jesus, And people would say that there are these predictions, these prophecies written in there that predicted Jesus, that talked about this Messiah that was going to come and he was going to suffer and be killed, and described the family that he would be from and the village that he would be from and things he would do and how people would do things to him and how he would interact with people, and very, very specific things that it would be impossible that when you put those together, they could point to anybody else except for this Jesus of Nazareth that history describes. But I always heard, you know what? Well, that's a perfect example of kind of revisionist history writing. You see, what happened was, even though those Old Testament books of the Bible were written well before Jesus' time, the oldest copies we have of them from scribes were actually from after Jesus' time. So a perfect example, they cooked the books. You know, somebody with an ulterior motive went in to prove a point, and they kind of revised things to make it look like it pointed to Jesus. Isaiah was a perfect example of that. The Old Testament book of Isaiah, which has some very interesting predictions about who this Messiah would be. Well, the oldest copy of Isaiah that they had was from about 1000 AD. So you know what? How can you argue that maybe somebody didn't cook the books? I mean, 1000 AD, that was well after Jesus' time. Maybe somebody did within those 1000 years. And then in 1947, something happened. In 1947, a shepherd about 10 miles east of Jerusalem in an area called Qumran was chasing one of his errant sheep, trying to find out where it had run to. And he started throwing rocks into these caves in the hills, trying to see if one of his sheep had gone into one of those caves and see if it would come out. He flushed it out with a rock. And he threw a rock into one of the caves, and the sound came back that didn't sound like the other rocks. And it sounded almost like a shattered pottery or something. And he crawled in the cave to see what it was. And within one fell swoop, his discovery moved the oldest copy of the book of Isaiah that we have from 1000 AD to 100 BC. 1000 years earlier now, the oldest copy that we had. It became known as the Dead Sea Scrolls discovery. And what was amazing, people waited with bated breath because this was the book of Isaiah. And the first thing they found that it was almost exactly identical to the copy they had from 1000 years later, other than some minor slips of the pen that had obviously happened with scribes, exactly identical. And the other thing they found was that the prophecies were there. Prophecies that have been written at least 100 years before Jesus. And you know what? These kind of things have happened again and again, just in our lifetime. I mean, U.S. News just in the last 5 years has reported some of the most significant archaeological finds, you know, in the last 100 years. And they all have, the ones they've talked about, they have verified the Bible. They have not found ones that point to some discrepancy in the Bible. It's happened again and again. But you know what? As I sat in this chair, that wasn't the most significant thing for me. Those all started to add up for me. But the biggest thing for me of asking this question, is it true, was the historical record of people, both Christians and non-Christians, of both people who supported Christ and people who tortured him, was this record of this strange thing that happened to Christ followers. This thing that people couldn't understand. And they wrote about the fact that Christ followers, you know, were basically a bunch of cowards when Jesus was crucified. I mean, they denied that they knew him. They ran, fled out of town. But then they started describing this strange thing that happened shortly after the crucifixion. These very people that had run and hid started pouring back into the town. And they came right into Jerusalem. They came right into the center of the city of Jerusalem. Just a stone's throw from the tomb that they were referring to. And they started to say these strange things. And they started to act in these brave ways they'd never indicated before. And they started to say, this guy Jesus that we all saw die, he's alive. I saw him and he talked to me. And they walked right back into the middle of Jerusalem that they had fled from and started telling anybody that would listen, Jesus lives. I saw him. He's alive. He talked to me. And you know what else they started saying? We're not alone. As a matter of fact, there's over 500 people that he's done this to. Go ask them. They're right there. They're right down the street. There's 500 people. Go talk to them. And over the course of time, the authorities, one by one, tracked down these disciples and told them, if you don't stop saying this, we will torture and kill you. And so these people that were screaming at the top of their lungs, Jesus is alive, this man who you killed is alive, and he's the Son of God, they were gradually beaten, beheaded, boiled, sawed in half, cut in two with swords, crucified upside down. And every single one of them went to their death saying, I cannot say it's not true. I saw it. I was there. And Roman historians, to this day, you can read the books where Roman historians have described these strange Christus followers who would not recant this story, and you couldn't even burn them at the stake, and they wouldn't change their tune. And so for me, the biggest thing in this chair was realizing that not only the ink from the hands of Jesus' enemies, but the blood of the martyrs all said one thing. this man who said he was God died and he rose again. Now, I'm not saying it was 100%. I believe God always leaves room for faith in the equation. But I have to admit that I came to a place in my rawest, most honest moments where I said, you know what? By the rules of fact and logic I use to apply to every other area of my life, if I'm going to be consistent, I've got to admit that the burden for unbelief on this thing is far greater than the burden of belief. The burden of unbelief is far greater than the burden of belief. So if I want to not believe, I've got to be inconsistent with how I apply truth in all other areas of my life. And you know what? I found I was not alone. I was not alone in people who have said, you know what? I do not feel that I am called to commit intellectual suicide to embrace my faith. I've got to lay things against this standard. And you know what? I don't want to put myself in the same breath as these people intellectually, but a long chain of people who have wrestled with the facts and come to the same conclusion, from J.R.R. Tolkien to Dr. Simon Greenleaf, who founded Harvard Law School, to right here in our seats today, Professor Paul Caron from the University of Cincinnati Law School, who came here not believing any of these facts, dug it into himself, passionately believes it now, and tells others. A long line of people said, I am not going to commit intellectual suicide to embrace my faith, but oh my God, this thing happened. Not metaphorically, not mythically, it really happened. And so I found myself in this chair, wrestling with my answer, was that it is true. Now, I'm not saying I liked it. I didn't like it. See, because for me, coming to an answer on this question really just drove me into another chair. And actually, this chair was much more disturbing than the first one. Okay, big deal. It's true. I found a much more disturbing question here. You know, in the course of the movie The Passion of Christ has been released, one of the predominant questions that's been bantered around out there as part of the controversy was, who killed Jesus? Who killed Jesus? And because in history, there have been these fringes that have said, oh, it was the Jews. It's their fault that Jesus died. Or, oh, it was the Romans. It's their fault. And, you know, when I started digging into the Bible, I realized that's not the question here. You know, because we see very clearly in the Bible that nobody did anything to Jesus that he didn't willfully submit himself to. That, as a matter of fact, he came here for the purpose of being killed. You look in the book of John, the New Testament of the Bible. This is one of the four historical records that's been collected in the Bible of Jesus' life. And Jesus is talking. He says, I lay down my life only to take it up again. No one takes it up from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have authority to lay it down and authority to take it up again. Well, you know what? When I read that, I now had a more disturbing question that I was sitting with. I didn't like this one at all. Why death? I mean, why death? Why? Okay, so he did die. Why? And I thought it was interesting, after I'd written that question this week, that the next day Time Magazine came out last week. The question on the cover right now. Why did Jesus have to die? And I think that's one of the most defining questions. Why? What problem was he solving? My problem? I was not aware there was a problem. Death? Death was the solution? Now, you know, I look around me in life and I see death, but I think death is much more the problem than the solution, don't you? And then I started to look a little bit deeper beyond the sound bites of how people describe Easter to what the Bible actually says about why this thing happened. And how the story that it tells of God and mankind and our interaction with God is one that God is the creator of everything. He created us. He breathes life into us. And that as any creation, we have a certain relationship of dependence on our creator. We are in a relationship of dependence. As created beings, we are dependent on our creator. And we not only have this vertical dependence that we are created for, but we also have this horizontal dependence where we're dependent on each other. I'm to lean into you, you're to lean into me. It's this thing called community. But in the course of our lives, that doesn't strike us quite well, this idea of dependence. Because what? How is one of the main ways we define happiness? Independence. The anti-dependence. I want to call all the shots. I want to make all my own calls. I want to be the dictator of my life. And in our quest for independence, we reject all dependence, even good dependence and dependence on God. We reject that. And by rejecting that, by definition, we are disconnected from our life source. And by definition, when you are disconnected from your life source, you are dying. And so what happens from all of our choices, which the Bible, all our bad choices, which the Bible calls sin, when we fall short of God's plan for us, we miss the mark. The result of all of our choices, the end result is death. Death of all kinds. Death of relationships. Death of communication. Death of honesty. Death of authenticity. And yes, physical death of our bodies. And so the outcome of this war of independence that we wage is what the Bible describes in the book of Romans. Therefore, just as sin entered the world through one man, and death through sin, in this way death came to all men, because all sinned. This is the problem. All of us, from Adam and Eve down to you and I, have brought sin and death into this world by choosing, in the name of independence, against what God's design for our life is. Because we shudder to think that there is a God who best prescribes how life is best lived. And, oh my goodness, there might just be a chance that I'm not living that way. So this is the problem. And so God looks at this creation and what's happened, and he says, I am not going to leave them alone on this thing. Now, I'm not going to implement some plan where I turn them all into robots so they only do the right thing all the time. No, but I am going to provide a way out for them. And God sends his son. He sends his son to conquer this thing called death for us. And what is the only way you really conquer things? What's the only way you really beat things as opposed to avoid them or deny them or go around them or have them catch up with you later? The only way you really conquer things is to go right through it. So God went through death to conquer death. Now, boy, this is where us enlightened Westerners, you know, we get more than a little queasy on this one. I mean, using death. I mean, couldn't he have found some more civilized solution? You know, some cleaner, more sanitized way of doing this. And you know what? It's a reasonable question from a culture like we have that has so grown to be a place where we try to deny death as much as possible. We try to remove any interaction with death to ways where we don't even have to look at it. We don't even need to be around. But by removing ourselves from that, we remove ourselves from a very real reality that the people of ancient Middle Eastern times hadn't removed themselves from. And that is the fact that death is part of life. As a matter of fact, we only live through death. But it's a reality we're able to avoid. I mean, let's face it. We are a culture who says, I want my fajitas, but would you please kill the chicken somewhere else? May have just put a dent in Don Pablo's lunch crowd today. You know, I apologize for that. You know, but we even design laws that say you can't even kill the chicken in the same building I'm going to eat it in. I don't want death anywhere around me. And you can even be a vegetarian, but you have to realize, even if you're a vegetarian, every single day what you eat are things that used to be alive. We only live through death every day, and that is a reality that was not lost on the ancient Middle Easterners who saw death and saw sacrifice every day. Things die so we can live. It is a reality as much as we try to avoid it, it is true. But that culture of the ancient Middle East is so foreign to us, of the death and the sacrifice and those kind of things, and we think that somehow that's more barbaric. But in fact, they were just playing the same game that we do, which it says, I realize that I'm disconnected to my life source, and now here's what I'm going to try to do. I'm going to try to reconnect without giving up independence. And so I'm going to, through my impressive efforts, work my way into God's graces. And that's what every world religion since the first person sinned has been trying to create, all these different flavors that puts it all right back in our lap. And whether it's Islam or whether it's Buddhism or whether it's even a lot of people's modern day versions of what Christianity is, it's all about me through my efforts without releasing my independence, through my efforts being good and working my way toward God. This was mine. This was kind of my version of this I worked out. See, my version was this scale. It's not really a standard, an absolute standard that God's going to judge me on. No, what it is it's more of a scale. And on this side is all the bad things, and on this side is all the good things. So I just need to kind of get things to weigh out this direction. You know, if I can just get it to tip a little bit this way on the good side, then I'm in. You know, on this side, you know, it was all the bad things. It was, you know, lying to people, betraying people, buying Kiss Love Gun without telling my parents, you know, basically all 4 years of college. They're right over here as well, right on the end. And then on this side is all the good things. Being kind to people, giving money to people who need it, you know, washing my hands when someone else is looking in the bathroom, you know, all those kind of things. And my goal... my goal was to make sure that this just kind of tipped this way so that the good outweighed the bad, and that would reconnect me to my life source. I could keep my independence. As a matter of fact, I could ramp it up in doing this and making sure it tipped this way. Now, here's the magic to my plan. This is the real kicker in it. See, the deal was, God wasn't going to judge me on some sort of absolute standard. You see, in my plan, it was all going to be graded on a curve. You know, I didn't have to be this absolute good for God. What I had to be is just a little bit better than most of you. Look around you right now. I had reason to believe this was going to turn out pretty well for me. That was the plan. That was the plan. This summer, through a gift of a friend, Nancy and I were able to go to this lodge out in this national park in Northern California. In this lodge, they had one of these things. It was kind of a water treadmill. Has anybody seen these? A place where you can swim in place. This current comes at you. It's only about the size of a car. You kind of swim in place as if you're on a treadmill and you get a workout. I was fascinated by this. Never seen one before. So, I really want to see this demonstrated. And I couldn't convince Nancy to get in the thing. So I decided, okay, I'm going to have to do this myself. So I got in. When I got in, I turned it on. It had a little, knob here where you could turn it, from 0 to 10 as far as how much current you want. So, I started, I get it to about 4 because, I'm in pretty good shape. I'm swimming along and I'm like, hey, yeah, I think. And my wife's, standing there watching. And I'm like, perfect demonstration that I've gotten into pretty good shape over the last 5 years. Pretty good. Doing pretty good. And then I decide, okay, well, how am I going to close this out? I guess what I could do is I could kind of crank it like to 7 or 8, get a little bit more of a workout, and then finish real big, on 10. Or I could just go ahead and crank it straight to 10. Because, chicks like that kind of stuff. Right? So that was the plan. That was the plan. So I cranked it straight to 10. I don't completely remember the next anywhere from 30 seconds to a minute or so. I'm not sure. I only know that I came to. This torrent of water. It was coming at me, and I was underwater with my back against the back of it, and I've got to start fighting, to peel my arms, and I'm looking up through the bubbling water trying to see the top, and I'm thinking, what? I'm thinking, what? Must live for the kids, right? Must, for the kids. It's for the kids. So, must live for the kids. And then through the bubbling water, all of a sudden, as I'm fighting my way back to the surface through the bubbling water, I see a vision. And I think that it's actually a real thing. It's not kind of a dead man's dying vision. It's my wife's face. And I figure that it's pretty much the real thing because, she's laughing. Okay? And I don't. In my vision, she wouldn't have been laughing. So she, and not like ha ha, but I mean she's laughing hysterically. This is the most fun she's had on this trip or any trip with me, I think ever. And yes, or. And I'm gurgling under the water, seeing her laughing, and I'm thinking, there's such a fine line between happy fun as a couple and just vicious payback for unresolved arguments, We're somewhere in between that zone. I'm finally able to fight my way to the surface, crawl on the side, turn it off, and, I'm fine. Thank you. I live to tell about it. That's such an experience of our life. That's what we do. We get on this treadmill and we say, I realize I'm disconnected from my life source. What's the answer? Swim harder. Swim faster. Measure up. Measure up. If you're a 4, get it to a 7 at least. Swim faster. And all of the world religions tell us that, whether it's through a series of lives and reincarnation, whether it's following the certain pillars of Islam, or in the spin that a lot of people have put on called American Christianity, it's about going to church and reading the Bible and praying, and all on your own efforts, working your way back to God, and it puts it all back in your lap. And Jesus said, this God-man Jesus came to earth and said, no, that's not it. You can never work your way back to God, but thank goodness you don't have to. I'm going right through death. I'm going right through death. And the result is what the Bible describes in the book of 2 Timothy. It says, it has now been revealed through the appearing of our Savior, Christ Jesus, who has destroyed death and has brought life and immortality to light through the gospel. He has destroyed death and brought life and immortality. What happened on Easter that we so gloss over is the fact that it was the death of death. Yes, these bodies after 80, 90, 100 years or so will still wear out. But we are not human beings on a spiritual journey. We are spiritual beings on a human journey. Our journey continues. We can, through Jesus' sacrifice, live forever. And what Jesus did was he said, I'm coming, and into the culture of that time, I'm going to take the worst they have to offer. I'm going to take the worst torture, the worst death, because I'm going right through this thing so you can never stop living. So in this chair, I found myself that the answer to why death was that God went right through death to conquer death. And then what he did was he gave us a creation and designed the world ever since then to be a constant reminder to us that it's only through death that we live. You know, even all that question did was drive me to a third chair. And the third question was like, okay, so it's true. Okay, so he went through death to conquer death. But so what? So what? I mean, okay, that's nice. Somebody should write a book, maybe make a movie about it. You know, but what does this mean to me? And as I sorted through that over the course of the years, I realized that what it means is that according to Jesus, what I think about him and how I respond to that will determine my destiny forever. The answer to so what is that I must respond. If I fail to accept and adjust to Jesus' sacrifice, I have not seen the death of death. But if I do, look what the promise is. I am the resurrection and the life, Jesus said. He who believes in me will live even though he dies, and whoever lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? I will never die. Now, I'd like to invite the band to come back out. The answer to so what is that I must respond. Even if you choose not to respond, that is a response. We don't have a choice when we're confronted with this information to not respond, even if our response is, I'm just not going to respond. But I want to ask you, you know, what is your response? How are you doing? What's your model? And how are you doing on it? What should your response be? During this song, that's what I want you to think about. And for those of you that say, I've never heard it explained quite this way. And you know what? I realize that this tension in my life is me trying to measure up. Me trying to do an impossible job. I want to give you just a simple prayer to say real quick during this song to God. Just under your breath, say, God, I can't measure up. And now I realize through Jesus' sacrifice, I don't have to. Please show me the reality of what that means. What more? What more could God do and still leave some room for faith?
This song, the lost ones sing. They are found and move from dark into the light.
Would you stand with me, please? The thing is, there is a perfect standard. Whatever that's in you that longs for something more than what you're feeling in that hole right now, it's created by God and it's meant to be there. The things in this life were not meant to totally fill that hole. And your desire for some sort of standard is a good thing. You just need to realize that there is a perfect standard and it's never going to be you. And that perfect standard was broken for us. So we could live forever. If you want to take these into your hands, if you just want to follow me on this, just bend it a little, feel that tension. Feel that tension. That's the tension of a life that's trying to do it on their own. That's the tension of a life that's prescribing to some religious philosophy that says that it's all back in my lap. But this, if you bend it just a little more, that is the passion. That is God's passion for you. Take these with you as just kind of a reminder of what ultimate reality really is. And have a great Easter.